This is VOA News, via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden used his first appearance at the NATO summit as president to call on Russian President Vladimir Putin to step back from provocative actions targeting the U.S. and allies. NATO allies, meanwhile, joined the United States on Monday in formally scolding Beijing as a constant security challenge. Biden said he had extensive talks with NATO leaders about his plans to meet with Putin Wednesday. He said all expressed support or gratitude for his plan to tell Putin directly to stop Russian-originated cyber attacks against the West and the violent stifling of political dissidents and cease Russian election interference outside its borders. Israel's new government has granted approval for a contentious parade by Israeli nationalists through Palestinian areas around Jerusalem's Old City. That decision raises the possibility of renewed confrontations just weeks after an 11-day war with Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip. Hamas called on Palestinians to resist that march. The parade was scheduled to take place on May 10th, but as it got underway, Hamas launched a barrage of rockets at Jerusalem, which sparked the war. UN refugee chief Filippo Grandi told Reuters on Monday that the United States, or I should say the United Nations, is preparing for a likely further displacement of civilians in Afghanistan after U.S. and international troops leave the country in September. Violence has been rising as foreign forces begin withdrawing, and efforts to broker a peace settlement between the Afghan government and insurgent Taliban have slowed. Grandi pointed to deadly attacks last week on an international mining organization in northern Afghanistan, which killed at least 10 people. There is more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. congressional leaders are honoring the nearly 600,000 Americans who have died of COVID-19 since the outbreak began. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Legislative leaders gather to mark a moment of silence. They bowed their heads but gave no speeches, concluding by joining the soloist in singing God Bless America. As they've done to show unity during other tragic events, President Biden marked the grim milestone while still overseas.
My heart goes out to all those who've lost a loved one.
The president says even though the death rate is dropping below 400 Americans a day,
it's still a real tragedy.
Having 600,000 COVID deaths is about equal to the number of Americans who died of cancer in 2019. But the true COVID death toll is believed to be much higher. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has confirmed the next planned relaxation of coronavirus restrictions in England will be delayed by 4 weeks until July 19th as a result of the spread of the Delta variant. In a press briefing Monday, Johnson voiced confidence that he won't have to announce a further delay to the plan to lift restrictions on social contact. He said the government will accelerate its vaccination rollout and that the decision to delay will save thousands of lives. New analyses by Public Health England showed the two doses of the main vaccines and the UK's rollout are highly effective against hospitalization from the Delta variant, which was first identified in India. Outgoing UN aid chief Mark Lowcock slammed the group of seven wealthy nations on Monday for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19, describing a G7 pledge to provide 1 billion doses over the next year as a small step. The leaders of the United States, Japan, Germany, Britain, France, Italy, and Canada met in Cornwall, England over the weekend and also agreed to work with the private sector, the group of 20 industrialized nations, and other countries to increase the vaccine contribution over months to come. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization's Director General on Monday welcomed the group of seven's weekend pledge of 870 million COVID-19 vaccine doses, but did say that many more were needed and quickly. A senior World Health Organization advisor said that Africa will get priority treatment for the group of seven's pledge 870 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 15, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya says it is ready to reopen its embassy in Somalia.
It is in the interest of both Kenya and Somalia to be able to find a meeting ground, because it is in their best interest that the relationships do not get any worse.
There's growing concern about political violence in Zambia ahead of that country's August 12 election. Anticipation is building in the Ivory Coast for this Thursday's expected return home of former President Laurent Gbagbo. Cameroon begs civilians to donate blood on World Blood Donor Day. And a Uganda military court releases 18 more opposition supporters.
Hundreds of Ugandans are still languishing in different prisons, gazetted and ungazetted, known and unknown. We continue to demand for them, and we encourage all of you to demand for the Ugandans that are incarcerated for no crime whatsoever.
And an Africano group trains South African farmers in self-defense. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya has asked Somalia to reopen its embassy in Nairobi. In a letter, Kenya's Ministry of Foreign Affairs acknowledged the invitation by the federal government of Somalia to restore diplomatic relations between the two countries. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, international relations affairs experts say the two countries are reviewing their relationship for mutual benefits.
Kenya is set to reopen its embassy in Somalia after the two states resolved a diplomatic standoff between them. In a statement by Kenya's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Kenya will utilize the latest talks to restore its relations with Somalia. Horn of Africa analyst John Gashie said that the two countries are saving each other because the two cannot afford to be in wrangles.
It is quite clear that neither of these two countries can afford to be at loggerheads. It is not practical and it's not pragmatic. Is it in the best interest of Kenya than Somalia, as we are at this particular moment, that the relationship, the country that perhaps stands more to lose directly in this regard, is Kenya, on the basis of the security issue.
In what is viewed as an attempt to strengthen the diplomatic ties, on 10th of this month, Kenya lifted its ban on direct flights to and from Somalia, a ban that was to last at least up to August 9th. In reply by Somalia on Kenya reopening of its airspace, Somalia said it was a step forward in enhancing bilateral trade, communication and movement of citizens between the two countries. Mr. Gashie says the two states are willing to work together despite the disputes.
It is in the interest of both Kenya and Somalia to be able to find a meeting ground, because it is in their best interest that the relationships do not get any worse. Somalia was, in this particular instance, trying to send a signal to Kenya, a very strong signal, that we are willing to overlook a few of the immediate issues if only we can be treated with a bit of decorum.
In November of 2020, Somalia dismissed Kenya's ambassador and recalled its ambassador from Nairobi in the latest dispute between the two countries. And this was not the first time there was a friction between Mogadishu and Nairobi. In 2019, Kenya also recalled its ambassador to Somalia following a maritime territorial dispute between the two countries, a matter that is currently being handled by the International Court of Justice. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
A military court on Monday released 18 members of the opposition National Unity Platform, including top aides to party leader Robert Tshakalu, also known as Bobi Wine. But Bobi Wine says the government should release hundreds more who, he says, are still being incarcerated at various detention centers. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala.
Military court martial president Lieutenant General Andrew Guti read out the ruling on bail application granting freedom to the National Unity Platform supporters.
This court finds merit in the application and hereby grants bail to the applicants on the following terms. One, the applicants should not go beyond the limits of Kampala and Wakiso District without court's permission. Two, the applicant should report to this court twice a month after every 14 days on Wednesdays.
The 18 supporters include Bobwen's bodyguard, Edward Sebufu, commonly known as Eddie Mutwe, and Ali Bokeni, a.k.a. Nubian Lee, Bobwen's singing partner. They were arrested in December last year during Bobwen's presidential campaign. Speaking after their release, Bobwen used the opportunity to ask the government to stop intimidating the opposition. He also called on the government to release many others he claimed are still being detained.
Hundreds of Ugandans are still languishing in different prisons, gazetted and ungazetted, known and unknown, for no crime whatsoever. Their only crime is to be Ugandan and for demanding for better. We continue to demand for them, and we encourage all of you to demand for the Ugandans that are incarcerated for no crime whatsoever. This is just the beginning.
Livingstone Sewanyana, head of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative, says the release of the opposition supporters was long overdue.
The idea of victimization should not be part of our democratic agenda now. So we urge all the parties concerned to ensure that there is timely and affordable access to justice for all persons at all times.
Dozens of opposition supporters were arrested during the presidential campaigns for what authorities alleged was unlawful possession of ammunition contrary to Ugandan laws, an accusation the opposition says is political witch hunt. For VOA News, I am Gume Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In Zambia, the Evangelical Youth Alliance, a civil society group, is expressing concern about growing clashes between supporters of the governing Patriotic Front Party and the opposition United Party for Democratic Development, UPND Alliance. The group warns that if not immediately addressed, the country could be plunged into chaos and bloodshed during the August 12th general election. Father Moses Longu is the president of the Evangelical Youth Alliance. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that it is unacceptable for citizens to die due to violence during an election process.
We commend the president for the intended action that is meant to safeguard the lives of the people. There is no need for Zambians to lose their lives because of politics and because of somebody who is aspiring to be a political leader of the country. And the government will do just the justice to the people by evoking his constitutional powers if the trend is left unchecked.
Father Lungu, yes. Why do you think the Zambian police, constitutionally mandated to maintain law and order, has remained unfortunately ineffective in addressing these challenges of politically related violence in Zambia?
Tribalism is at play because those are mostly the police officers that hail from tribes where they have been advocating tribalism. They are the ones that actually have betrayed the whole system. When people abrogate their professional obligation, then it becomes a very serious matter that weakens across the police service, because you don't know who you are trusting and what is it that they are doing in their dark corner meetings. So the unfortunate thing is that these people have infiltrated the police, they've infiltrated the Electoral Commission of Zambia, and they've made these institutions weak by abrogating their professional etiquette in discharging their duties.
So are Zambians rather calling on the president to invoke his presidential powers to ensure peace and stability before the elections, or they want institutions mandated by the Constitution? Of course, the president is also mandated by the Constitution to ensure lives and property are protected.
Well, Zambians, majority Zambians that put this government into office are looking forward to the instructions that will be instituted by the president, because they are witnessing disappointment from these institutions that are mandated and are expected to execute their duties professionally. For instance, we've been warned that due to COVID, there is no need for us to be holding rallies. But we have seen the opposition defying with impunity. And right now, our hospitals are full. We don't have space. We are running out of oxygen. Now, there are these few elements that have malicious intentions. We don't know because they needed to sell themselves, to market themselves peacefully to the citizens so that they can be elected into office. But again, there is every information available that should help the police to go and arrest the perpetrators of violence.
That was Father Moses Longu, president of the Evangelical Youth Alliance of Zambia. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 15. In Ivory Coast, anticipation is building for this Thursday's expected return home of former President Laurent Gbagbo. The French news agency reports that Mr. Gbagbo's supporters in his hometown of Mama have been jubilating in anticipation of his arrival. Yesterday, Monday, President Alassane Ouattara announced he was making available the presidential pavilion in Abidjan to welcome former President Gbagbo. The government has also promised to pay for the travel arrangements of the former president and his family. Information Minister Amadou Coulibaly says making the presidential pavilion available is a confirmation of President Ouattara's disposition to receive former President Gbagbo and to grant him all the advantages reserved for a former president.
On April 7, during the first meeting of the Council of Ministers of Prime Minister Achipatrick's government, President Ouattara announced that Mr. Gbagbo Laurent could return to Cote d'Ivoire whenever he wanted. For us, opening the presidential lounge to Mr. Gbagbo Laurent is a confirmation of President Ouattara's disposition to receive the former head of state and to grant him the advantages due to his status. Here, Mr. Laurent Gbagbo is a former president of the Republic. The law gives him certain rights.
I think that it's not a question of feeling or state of mind.
Is it true that President Ouattara or the Ivorian government has pledged to be responsible for former President Gbagbo's travel arrangements, paying for his travel?
I think that it's a question of responsibility. We want a peaceful return from Mr. Gbagbo Laurent. However, the supporters of Mr. Gbagbo know that when you call for a demonstration and that there is trouble during this demonstration, you are obviously responsible for these troubles. So it's for us a question of responsibility, and all the commodity offered for the peaceful return of Mr. Gbagbo in Cote d'Ivoire show all the willingness of Mr. Ouattara to receive him.
What can you tell us about the military incident that reportedly took place on Saturday on the Ivorian border with Burkina Faso?
Indeed, on Saturday, a military vehicle was the victim of an improvised explosive device. We unfortunately lost three of our soldiers and recorded four wounded, as announced in the press release of the General State of the Army, General Lassana Doumbia.
That was Ivory Coast Information Minister Amadou Coulibaly speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. A new investigation shows that social media accounts linked to politicians in the Democratic Republic of Congo have been leading a campaign of disinformation against whistleblowers in the country. According to Global Witness, after the group uncovered evidence indicating mining magnate Dan Gertler may have used an international money laundering network to attempt to evade United States sanctions and continue business in DRC, an online attack were launched against the Congolese whistleblowers, as well as Global Witness. The group's data investigations advisor, Louis Garda, tells Ricky Stryer how they investigated the social media account that was spreading misinformation and linked them to officials such as ex-president Joseph Kabila.
We were able to establish links between these Twitter accounts and a PR firm that's done work previously for the Congolese government and for the state mining company, Gécamines, various officials related to those companies. CMCT TCG, or CMCT, the Communications Group, which is a PR company based in Kinshasa, And this is the company that's done work for the Congolese government in the past, and for Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, and for Denis Sassou Nguesso, the president of Congo Brazzaville, as well in the past.
Is this continuing? What's the ongoing situation? And is it having an impact on Global Witness's ability to do work, or the investigator's ability to do work?
No, I wouldn't say it's impacted us in that sense. I wouldn't want to speak for my colleagues who are the experts on DRC, but it's created some confusion and some difficulty operating in that country, just because of the rumours and the sort of backlash that has been kind of swirling in the wake of these things. But no, I think we've been able to kind of see through it, luckily. And so part of this investigation that I've been doing recently is to sort of put our side of the story and to kind of establish that these are not legitimate accounts. I mean, it's been interesting to see the response of social media networks and, you know, Twitter in particular to this kind of stuff. I noticed that a couple of the accounts that were tweeting these kind of videos were temporarily suspended by Twitter automatically, probably due to some algorithm kind of automatically detecting likely fraudulent activity, but they've all been restored. So we haven't contacted Twitter to have them suspended, because it's actually quite interesting to just see what they go on and do.
Is it having a chilling effect on workers, civil society workers and activists inside the country?
I'm not sure about that, to be honest. I think it's certainly had an effect on people's perceptions of the issues at stake, just with the social media use in DRC is quite high, and, you know, people are sort of seeing these videos being circulated. But I wouldn't know if it kind of translated into anything more serious than that.
You know, are there tools legal tools at people's disposal within DRC, for example, that help them fight these kind of online smear campaigns? Or, you know, is it all this gray area at the moment?
You know, but I would think that the way to tackle it is really to on a sort of first level to do the sort of analysis that we've done to attempt to identify the accounts, and then to put pressure on the social media companies themselves to suspend and monitor this kind of stuff better in the future. I think that would probably be the most effective way to try and counter this kind of thing, rather than pursuing it through the courts. So as we've seen with the whistleblowers, the legal system can't always be necessarily relied upon.
That was Louis Goddard, Data Investigations Advisor for Global Witness. You're speaking to Ricky Stryer from Cambridge. Medical authorities in Cameroon are pleading for blood donors after a dramatic drop in donations over the past year. Donations fell by half in 2020, then by nearly half again so far this year, worsening the country's blood shortage. For World Blood Donor Day yesterday, June 14, Moki Enwikizeka reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
Officials in Cameroon point to 32-year-old Alphonse Souchia as a good example of a determined voluntary blood donor. Chia says he became a blood donor when he witnessed an incident in which medical staff could not help save the life of a child. He says he started donating blood in February after he watched helplessly as a 6-year-old boy died of severe anemia in the central hospital in Yaoundé. He says the medical staff members on duty told him that the blood bank was dry and there was no one to donate blood to save the child's life. Chia says he was being treated for malaria at the hospital and could not donate blood at the time. He says since then, he has joined an association called Green Hearts that donates blood to people in need. Cameroon says it needs 400,000 pints of blood each year to meet the medical needs of its 25 million people. But in 2020, people donated just 48,000 units of blood, down from 103,000 units in 2019. The Central African State says blood donations have fallen again so far this year. Dorangumsu Mbanya is Director General of Cameroon's National Blood Transfusion Center. She says COVID-19 scares people from donating blood.
With the COVID pandemic in 2020, there was a deficit of 44% in blood donation. What we gathered is that COVID had a huge impact on blood donation. WHO set out criteria whereby if you are a recovered person from COVID-19, you are allowed a month or so after recovery before you could be eligible to donate.
Vanya says popular myths surrounding blood donation and transfusion are also an obstacle.
There are those who think that you take their blood and do witchcraft with it, and so they cannot donate their blood. There are those with religious beliefs that you can't take blood from one person and give to the next person. Those kind of people will not want to donate blood, since they would not even receive it. And so we want to encourage our young people to step forward and take leadership roles in promoting health in our nation through blood donation.
With Cameroon battling a separatist crisis in two western regions, Boko Haram attacks in the north and occasionally spillover of violence from the Central African Republic, the government says the need for blood to treat wounded civilians and fighters is higher than ever. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
In South Africa, a group called AFRI Forum has launched a self-defense training for white commercial farmers. The group says the farmers are vulnerable to attacks, which it says are driven by tensions over unequal farmland distribution more than 25 years after the end of apartheid. Franco Puglisi reports from Pretoria, South Africa.
South African farmer Shernice Potgieter, a young single mother, lived in a tranquil, remote rural farmhouse with her daughter Denise and two dogs for 8 years. That peaceful existence was shattered on a summer morning when she returned home after dropping Denise off at school. Potgieter recalls horror when two men emerged from the cornfield, tied her up, and ransacked her farmhouse.
This is the passage where they made me lie down. I had to lie here so that I couldn't see outside. When it started, I just thought to myself, today I'm losing my life. When I saw them coming for me, the first reaction was, today I'm going to die. I was worried about my daughter and what would happen to her, say something would happen to me.
While Potgieter survived the ordeal, Afrikaner rights group AfriForum says 59 white farmers were killed in 2020 alone, a 30% increase in fatalities from 2019. Although the motive for these attacks has not always been attributed to racial tension, AfriForum says most perpetrators are black. In January, the group began a self-defense program for commercial farmers, the majority of them white Afrikaners. AfriForum legal and risk manager Marnus Kempfer gives an overview of the training.
The first aspect of the training will be how to use a firearm. We show them how to use this firearm in and around the house. We then also issue them with a digital radio. We actually give them training in how to exactly utilize this radio. In the end, we want all of these farmers and their neighbors to have an effective communication network.
Tension spiked in October 2020 when a white farmer was killed and his body found tied to a pole in the town of Senegal in an eastern part of the Free State province. The incident heightened racial tension in the area and politically motivated protests followed. Racial anger, observer says, is fueled by the fact that the white farmers still own 70% of South Africa commercial farms, 27 years after the end of apartheid. Group representing white farmers like Transvaal Agricultural Union South Africa accuse authorities of failing to protect them. Black farmers also have been victimized by these attacks, but to a lesser degree, says the farmer union. Franco Puglisi for VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a good day.